Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and at the Savvy Dentist Podcast. Great to have you company for another episode of the show. Now, if you're a motivated, driven practice owner, come along and find us in the Savvy Dentist Facebook group. We'd love to welcome you there because in that group, we have some tools, some training, and a community of like-minded people who, like you, are on a quest to create a great practice and a wonderful life. So if that's you, all you need to do is head across to Facebook, find us in the search bar, and then answer the membership questions, and we'd love to welcome you in. Now, my guest today is someone really special. I'm talking to Carol Cook, who is a gold medal Paralympian. She's had an incredible career. She is got to be one of the oldest Paralympians. I'm not sure if she's the oldest, but she's had an incredibly long career. And what is remarkable about Carol's career is her tenacity, her grit, her stickability. It is something I've never seen it before. I'm really honestly, I've never seen someone with such strength of character before. And listening to her story, I've got to tell you, I got a bit emotional. It's an incredible story of grace. It's an incredible story of courage. It's an incredible story of tenacity. And I just love talking to her. And I know that you'll love listening to this episode as well, because so many wonderful life lessons, so many wonderful business lessons, all wrapped up in an engaging and entertaining life story. And without any further ado, here's Carol Cook. Carol Cook, thank you so much for taking the time to come and join us on the Savvy Dentist Podcast. How are you today, all the way in Melbourne?
Oh, I'm very good, Jesse. I'm staying out of the rain today.
Which is a good thing and a bit of an achievement in and of itself, because there's a lot of rain to stay away from.
Oh, definitely. And I even got training in this morning, though, because I've got a kicker trainer, a Wahoo kicker. So I was online on Zwift and doing my training inside while it rained outside, which is even better.
There you go. Okay. Well, I'm going to say I wasn't quite as dedicated as that this morning. So maybe I'll have to do it this afternoon and make it up. Carol, you've got a really interesting story. You know, you've represented Australia at the highest level in sports, and you know, your journey though begins, you know, many, many years ago, as a young athlete in gymnastics and then swimming. And I wondered if we could just talk a little bit about your background. Obviously, you ended up going to the Paralympics and achieving wonderful success there and the World Championships. But every story has an origin, and I'm always interested in the origin because it tells so much about you as a person. I'm curious to understand your origin story.
Well, I guess, you know, like any good mother, she had her daughters in, you know, tap and ballet and gymnastics and twirling a baton at the age of four. I was. And I remember at 7 years old watching my very first Olympic Games, and it would have been the Mexico Games in 1968. Well, there you go. That tells you how old I am. And and I remember watching these female gymnasts, and I was mesmerized. And I just thought, right then and there, I just went, yep, that is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a gymnastic Olympian for Canada. And that was at seven. That was like all I could see was those Olympic rings and me doing the tumbles. Now, if you see me in person, I'm definitely not the build of a gymnast. But at seven, I didn't know that. And I remember at nine, my best friend Sharon Emsley and I, she lived two doors down from us, and we went to try out for an elite gymnastics club. And her mom had driven us that day. And so I was so excited. You know, we ran into this front of foyer of this gymnasium, and I gave the lady my name and I said, I'm here for the tryouts. And, you know, I had all these grandeur things going through my head of I'm going to be the best there is in the tryouts. And she pointed me to another lady against the wall. And so she took my height and then pointed to a set of scales. And said, and she was a pretty gruff lady, and she said, stand on these. And so I stood on the scales, and in a really loud voice, she said, you're too fat for gymnastics. You can't come in.
Whoa.
And yeah, in front of everybody.
Oh, no.
And I was crushed, but I was trying to hold back the tears and trying to be very stoic at nine. Oh. And the worst part is that my best friend got to go in. She was a tiny little pixie girl, and she ended up being a very pretty good gymnast. But in the meantime, I'm sitting in the foyer for over an hour because I can't get home because her mom had driven us. So I remember she came out, we got in the car, Not a word was said. I just couldn't speak. I knew if I opened my mouth, I would cry. And I remember getting out of the car in their driveway and running down the street to my house through the back door and slamming the door, you know, up four stairs, down the hallway, into my bedroom, slamming the door. And I dove face first onto my bed and just burst into tears. And while I was on my bed and I was literally sobbing and I could hear my mom coming down the hallway. She was obviously coming to give me hell for slamming doors. But she opened the door and saw me and she just a mess. And she sat down and she put her arm around me. And I remember my head in her chest and I was, she's like, what has happened? What's the matter? And I said, I'm too fat for gymnastics. They wouldn't even let me try out. I can't ever do gymnastics. And she sat me up and she said, stop right there. And that day she gave me two good pieces of advice. She said, Carol, never in life let anybody tell you what you can and can't do. If you want to do gymnastics, then you keep doing gymnastics. If that's what you love, who cares what she thinks? You just do it. And then she said, which completely changed my life, she said, but think about this. If you want to go to the Olympics and you can't get there in gymnastics, then maybe you should try another sport. Ah. And it was something that I had never, ever thought about because I was so focused on one thing. And in that instant, she was making me think outside the square. And she was building my resilience. And she was teaching me that if there's not one way to get there, then maybe there's another way. And to be honest, for the last 52 years of my life since that day, I've used that every time I've had a challenge where I've either failed to be able to do something or get somewhere, or you know, with health issues, it's like reframing things. Okay, how am I going to do this then? And I take that back to that 9-year-old girl and what she taught me. And it's just been so helpful in every aspect of life.
Well, I love the reframe. I love the reframe. But if I could go back in time, I'd love to give that lady at the gymnastics club a few words because I just can't believe, honestly, that just breaks my heart.
Well, unfortunately, you know, it hasn't been that long since we've been body shaming girls and women. And, you know, we're only now starting to see some change come in, but there's still a lot of it. I mean, you look at the trolls on social media and they're still body shaming people.
Well, actually, I was telling you off air that I've got a daughter who's a gymnast, and I actually haven't really shared this out loud ever before, but the gymnastics club, you know, they do the whole Instagram thing and all the rest of it, which just, anyway, that's a whole next level of wrong on so many levels.
Yeah.
But the club themselves put up a picture of the gymnasts and asked them to vote on who was the best looking gymnast in there.
Oh.
So what on earth?
Oh my goodness. No.
And
that
like, there
is
was
just not right.
It's totally wrong. And there was a massive outcry, as you'd expect and appreciate.
Oh, good.
And it was taken down. But I thought, on what planet is that okay? Because it's just wrong on so many levels. But anyway, I'm sorry. I've just taken this off on a tangent.
But that's what I mean. You know, like even now, that was 52 years ago, and even now we're doing stuff like that. So we really, as a society, haven't learned yet.
No,
we really haven't learned. You know, who cares what size somebody is if they're enjoying doing what they're doing?
Let them go.
Then let them do it.
Yeah. 100%. So I want to ask you about this resilience piece because as a little 9-year-old, that can be a crushing thing. Thank goodness for your mum and her wisdom because, I mean, that's a gift.
Oh, definitely.
I'm curious to ask about the next sport. I think I know which one it is, but what was the thought process about, okay, well, if it's not gymnastics, then what?
Well, honestly, the only other sport, and I never really thought of it as sport because I was so fixated on gymnastics, but was swimming because we had a cottage in Northern Ontario in Canada that, you know, every summer we spent up there and we were constantly in the water. And so I was really bad at ball sports. So forget about volleyball, basketball, baseball. Like my coordination skills were just not there.
Okay.
And so I loved swimming. And literally, we would spend 2 months of the summer in the water. Mm. So I thought, well, why don't I try swimming? And I joined a swim club when I was 10. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I took to it like a fish, I guess you could say. And it became my love, my passion. And I guess by the time I was 15, I was training 5 hours a day, you know, before school, after school. And that was, you know, 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, with a 2 hour session on a Saturday and then a Sunday off, you mm-hmm. know, and I learned how to fit everything in because I was told, my parents told me if I didn't keep my marks up, which I wasn't the best student in the world anyway, but if I started failing things, then that passionate part of my life, the swimming, was out.
Yeah.
You know, so you really learn to structure your life so you get stuff done. Yeah. So at 15, I decided that my next goal, my goal would be the 1980 Moscow game.
Mm. And
we know what happened to the Moscow.
Yeah, we know what happened to those of us who are old enough to remember know what happened to the Moscow.
Exactly.
We're dating ourselves here, right?
Yeah. Most of the Western world boycotted those games because, funny enough, Russia had invaded Afghanistan. So the U.S. weren't happy about that. And so they decided that, nope, not going, and they asked the Western world to agree with them, except Great Britain and Australia. Mm. So they actually, athletes, make their own decision because the Olympics and sport should not be based around politics. Unfortunately, we know it is. But those two countries at least gave their athletes the opportunity to make that decision whether they wanted to go or not. So that was great. But then that dream, like just like my gymnastics dream, was like, okay, I was 18 years old. And back then, if you hadn't made it as a swimmer, a female swimmer at 18, you were basically washed up.
Yeah, wow.
You know, most of the world record holders, we had one in Canada, Nancy Garapic, world record holder in backstroke at the age of 13. You know, so at least now we know that women get stronger into their 20s and 30s. And even Dara Torres from the U.S. was 41 in Beijing at the Olympics, and she won 3 silver medals in the sprint events.
Wow.
So, you know, we know that women can get stronger, especially through their 20s and into early 30s. And even after having babies, you know, they are still around, and we've proven that now. There's so many mothers doing high-level sport. So at 18, though, it was like, well, I haven't made it, so what do I do? So mom's lesson again, you know, reframe your thinking. What are you going to do now? And I went right to the dark side, and I joined the police force.
that seems like such a diametrically opposed life choice, doesn't it? Like, I'm an athlete, I'm a policeman or policewoman. What was the decision? I'm just trying to figure out what was the thought process, because it doesn't seem like a logical or natural thing.
I know for most people it wouldn't be logical, but I came from a policing family.
Ah, okay.
So my grandfather had been a policeman. My dad was a policeman on the Toronto Police Force, a 39-year policeman. He met my mom when she was a policewoman on the force. She was only on for a few years back in the 50s. Mm. And actually the 14th woman ever hired on the Toronto Police Force.
Oh, wow.
So she was pretty groundbreaking woman back then. Mm. And I always said I would never join the police force. But at 18, I'd finished high school, and we didn't have anything in Canada that you call here the gap year. I'd never heard of that till I came here. But I didn't want to go to university for a year. Mm. So my mom said, well, if you're not going to school in university, then you need to find a job. And so I joined initially as a clerk in the records bureau. And after a few months there, I was like sucked right in. And I thought, I can go out and make a difference in this world. I learned pretty quickly I wasn't going to do that on my own.
Yeah.
But, you know, at 18, it was like, yeah, man, I could go out and change the world. And so I joined. And that was the start of a 14-year career, which saw me start in uniform, then work 4 years undercover, and then move into the detective office. So, yeah. Big change in life.
Yeah, huge change. What I'm always drawn by, or you know, fascinated by, is the similarities, the differences, how one experience builds upon another. Because I really believe that we go through life accumulating these experiences that, you know, create us as a person.
Yeah.
And I wondered, what did you take into policing from your elite sports background? And equally, what did policing give you that you now rely on and find helpful?
Oh, look, policing, well, from my sports background, I guess it was the mindset of I can accomplish anything.
Yeah.
And I really have had that. Yeah, I guess I've had that my whole life. I think it comes right back to that nine-year-old that if you want to do something, you can accomplish it, just do it differently. And I guess, you know, that high-performance mindset just made it that much easier to transition to something else and setting goals and how to set goals. And I guess joining the police force, joining as a clerk first, it was just, I've got a job for a year, then I'm going to go back to school. But in the area I was working, I saw, I typed up stories for the media that major detective or made the homicide squad would ring in and I'd be typing, you know, the old Olivetti typewriter. Uh-huh. I'd be typing up a story, that was to go to the press.
Mm.
Or I'd be taking information on major arrests and typing those up. Everything, this is well before the world of the internet,
yeah,
and computers, you know, we typed everything and it was paper-based and I saw these things coming in and that 18-year-old said, man, I could help change this world by doing something different. I still kept sport in my life though. And that's one thing I didn't say. I still kept swimming with the club that I was with.
Okay.
I was still racing, you know, just local competition, as the old lady when I hit like 20, 21. I was like, oh my God, I was the old lady. We've got this old lady swimming with us. And through the police force, we still had sport within the force, which was great because 1985, the very first World Police and Fire Games were held in San Jose, California. And they had, it was like the Olympics for police and fire, emergency services.
Mm.
And so, you know, at that point I thought, wow, like I've done it. I've reached the pinnacle of my sport because I'm racing at the World Police and Fire Games, which was the pinnacle of what I could do there.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, sport has, you know, been there all the time. When I left policing, what I've taken from that, I've had to leave some of it behind because with policing, you become very, and it's taken a long time to get back to normality, I guess I could say. You become very suspicious of people. You prejudge. You have to prejudge as a police officer while you're walking into situations. You have to think what could happen here, you know, not think about it after the fact. You need to think about it before you get in there. So you're prejudging situations, you're prejudging people. And I found that when I left policing, that can be really bad when you don't have to worry about that kind of thing. And even now to this day, if my husband and I go to a restaurant, after working for 4 years undercover, I always pick the seat that has my back to the wall. So I've got a complete view of the door and people coming in. And he knows that it drives me nuts if I can't see what's happening. And so he'll at times jump in the seat that he knows I want to sit in. Which is good in an aspect, but one aspect, because it's trying to reframe me.
Personal growth, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Reframe my thinking that, Carol, not everybody's bad that's coming in behind you. But it still drives me nuts. so there's little things, unfortunately, that stay with you as a police officer that you can't get past, which is, you know, as much as I try, I still like having my back to the door. Even in my office here, you know, my back is to the door, but I turn my computer and my laptop and I sit so that I've got that peripheral vision of the door, the window. It's really bizarre. It's really bizarre.
Well, it's just one of those quirks that comes with being a police officer for that period of time.
That's true. And I think the other thing I've taken out of policing for me, it was the professionalism that I tried to espouse. I wanted to be professional. I didn't want to be, you know, I know we hear so many stories about the bad police officers, you know, on the job. And it's like a 1% of the people who are on the job who do mess up. It's like any job, you know, you're always going to have somebody that does the wrong thing. But don't tar everybody with the same brush.
Yeah.
You know, so I really like, I think I've brought, now that I'm into sport for the second time in my life, elite sport, I've brought that professionalism, I think, from policing into what I do.
So that's a really good segue into your second chapter, really, of elite sport. And I wanted to talk about inflection points in your life, because you've had a couple. That nine-year-old experience at the gymnastics was obviously another. I imagine the Moscow Olympics and it being boycotted was another. And, of course, there was another couple of big inflection points in your life, and I'm wondering if we can just, you know, talk about those for a second in your story. So what happened?
Oh, well, I guess there's probably about three.
Yeah.
So I guess the first one is when I was on the police force, I was in the detective office. I was involved in a really horrendous sexual assault case that I worked on for a couple months, and it really got the better of me. I won't even go into detail because it was horrendous. And the court system was just horrendous. And unfortunately, I don't think it's changed much. And I didn't think that I could keep doing this job. And so I decided I needed to take time away from it.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked for a leave of absence, which I got. I got a year's leave of absence. And I came to Australia. Because I'd met through the police and fire games, I had met a whole bunch of Melbourne Fire Brigade members and their wives. And I had been traveling to Australia. So that was 85 when I met them. This is now 92.
Yeah.
And I'd been coming back and forth to Australia for holidays because I'd become very good friends with a lot of these people that I'd met at the first games. So I thought, nah, I got to do it right. I'm going to take a year off. I'm going to go down there and drive around the country. So I did. So that was a really big change in my life where I just got into a car, a 76 Ford Falcon, dual fuel, and I drove 37,500 kilometers around the country with my bicycle on the back, a tent in the boot, and met some incredible people, had some incredible experiences. And then just a couple months before I was going home, I met my husband.
Of course you did.
It's probably good that I met him towards the end,
mm-hmm.
because I don't know if I would have done what I had done, you know, beforehand. Anyway, I had to go back to work because I had no money. So that was a really big turning point. I'd made that decision when I was here for a year that policing was not what I wanted to do, but I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Mm.
I had no idea. And as a police officer, you're trained, they spend so much money training you that at the beginning, they make you feel like you can't do anything else. This is what you're made for. This is what you're trained for. And you can't do anything else. Anyway, I came back and went back to work, and I was working as a training officer in uniform. And I thought, oh God, this is not what I want to be doing. And finally, Russ and I traveled back and forth for about 8 months. And I was down here in June of 94. And he finally popped the question. I didn't believe him, but he called my dad. So it made me believe that, yeah, he was
serious. Yeah.
Being honest and being serious.
Yeah.
And so that just changed the whole direction of my life. I went back, you know, I was back at work. I put in my papers, and August 31st, 94, I boarded a plane and headed to Australia. So all of a sudden now I'm coming to a country that I had a few friends, but I had no work and I didn't know what I was going to do. So that was a big change. But in fact, it was a great change. I joined Australia Post. I started building my career within Post. I started as a driver, worked my way up through management. And I guess it was 1998. Well, Russ and I got married in 95. And then 1998, I had some really unusual symptoms. I swam with the Masters Swim Club. I was still swimming. And we were down in Hobart at the Masters Nationals. And I was really looking forward to competing because I felt like I'm in good shape. I'm going to do well. And I swam like a rock. It was terrible. It was extremely hot in Hobart that year. It was like 40 degrees.
Mm.
There was no air conditioning in the pool, so it was stifling. I thought I had the flu coming on. And when I got home, I was just really lethargic. After 8 hours sleep, I couldn't get out of bed. My balance started to go and my eyesight went. So I was getting double vision and my eyes felt like they were shaking side to side. And my GP thought I had an inner ear infection, which made sense. Went to get my eyes tested because they were going wonky. and failed a field vision test badly. And so this young optometrist said, "Oh, give me your doctor's name and number because maybe the infection spread to your optic nerve." And she called him and she said, "Send her to a neurologist. She's got optic neuritis and it's a precursor for multiple sclerosis," which he had never even thought about.
Mm.
So next thing you know, I'm seeing this neurologist. He sent me for a whole bunch of tests, and it was then April, and it's funny how we remember dates and times. Mm. April 23rd, 1998, 2:15 p.m. was my appointment time. And the day I was going, all my symptoms were gone. Now, I'd had like 2 months off of work.
Mm.
And all of a sudden, my symptoms are gone. So I felt like a real fraud going to see him, thinking, yeah, it was just that inner ear infection which had spread. Anyway, I get there and he's really gruff. Now, this man was probably over 70. He mm-hmm. had to be over 70. He probably should not have been still practicing.
Mm.
And he was the first neurologist that we could get into in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And he gruffly opened his office door and, "Hurry up, get in here." I'm like, "Oh, okay." And he points to a chair and he goes, "Sit down." I'm thinking, yep, he's pissed off that I'm here and I'm wasting his time. And he pulled my MRI film out of the envelope and he held it to the ceiling light. And he went, "Well, too many lesions on your brain for someone your age. So you've got multiple sclerosis and basically your life, as you know, it's over. So I'd suggest you go home and put your affairs in order before you become incapacitated."
Oh, bloody hell.
And I'm sitting there and it was like, I felt like I'd been hit by a bus. Oh. And I looked up at him and I remember saying, "What?" And he goes, "You heard me. You've got MS. So this silly sports stuff you do, you're never going to do that again. And you're going to have to quit work and go on a whole bunch of drugs. And to be honest, I don't have time for you as a patient. I've got enough people with MS already to deal with. Go back to your own GP. He can look after you."
Oh, my God. Oh,
he was a lovely man.
He must have been. He must have been related to that lady in Canada from 9 years.
Oh, probably. Yeah. Probably. And I just sat there and I think there was only one word going through my head, and that was incapacitated, and the fact that he'd mentioned sports, no sports. And, you know, being a lifelong sports fanatic, and even though I wasn't a ball sport person, I loved watching, you know, football, baseball, all that kind of stuff. That incapacitated word was probably the worst word that could ever been used, because I went to the real dark side of that word that day, and where I was lying in a bed, incontinent, unable to speak, unable to feed myself, and dependent on somebody for every aspect of life. Like, that's where I went.
Mm.
And he walked to the door, putting the film back in the envelope. I still hadn't said anything but "What?" And he opened the door and he said, "Hurry up, I've got people waiting." And I just stood up I was in a stupor. I just didn't know what to say or what to think. And I walked towards him and he slammed the envelope into my chest and he had the audacity to say, "See my secretary on the way out." And I walked straight by his secretary's office. And as I reached the front door, it was an old Victorian terraced house, a two-story house. And I heard her yelling from her office, "Mrs. Cook, Mrs. Cook, your bill." And I just opened the door and walked out. And funny enough, to this day, I don't remember if I ever paid that bill. I don't even remember getting the bill. But, you know, had I not been who I was, and those lessons that I'd learned through life and been through what I'd been through, like with policing and sport and whatever, that could have very well been the last day of my life, walking out that door.
Mm.
I don't remember driving home.
Wow.
I don't remember getting in the car, driving home. I know how I would have got home, but I don't remember even getting out of the car to open up. We had big double gates to open up the gates to actually park. I don't remember doing that. The next thing I remember is sitting in the house in tears, and we had a 6-month-old puppy who jumped up onto my lap and started to whimper because I was crying. And that snapped me right out of that, you know, where I went, "Oh, it's all right, Kimba, you'll be fine. You know, we'll be fine. And don't cry." And at that point, I made decisions, which I now know you never make decisions when you've just heard traumatic news or been involved in something, because you just don't know what the future holds, and you can't make those decisions until you have information.
Mm.
And I decided that we'd just bought a house the year before. I was going to give Russ the house, give him the divorce, and then go home to Canada because I was going to be incapacitated. Mm. And I was going to let my family look after me. And luckily, Russ is a pretty, you know, I'd call him a third income bush boy, Aussie bush boy.
Yeah.
And when he came home, I said to him, I told him what the doctor had said. And I said, now, before you say anything, I've made some decisions. And I told him. And to be honest, he looked at me. And I hope you don't mind a few swear words.
No, you go for it.
He looked at me and he goes, oh, God, you're a fucking idiot. And I just said, no, haven't you heard what this doctor said? He goes, he's a bigger one. And I just went, I didn't know what to say. And he said, Carol, we don't know anything about this disease. And he said, we need to find out before we make any decisions. And he doesn't know. You're fine right now. Like, are you sure you have MS? Like, you're fine. You have no symptoms. And, you know, since learning about MS, that is the way MS works. You know, relapsing and remitting. You can have symptoms. They can go away. They can come back. They can go away. It's off and on. So, you know, I'm pretty lucky. Well, not pretty. I'm very lucky that I have somebody in my life who was able to say, nope, hang on, let's find out.
Mm.
Instead of, oh shit, I'm running away.
Yeah.
Which happens a lot. And I know a lot of people with MS whose partners, male and female, have gone, nope, can't deal with this. And that's it. They're gone.
Yeah. Wow.
So
wow.
I'm very lucky, you know, and we've been married 27 years now. So it hasn't all been, you know, rosy and champagne. We've had our ups and downs and it's been tough, but, you know, we've been able to work through it. And I'm lucky I have an amazing GP who I still see all these years.
Isn't that amazing?
And when I went back to see him, he just went, Carol, I cannot deal with this. He says, you need somebody who specializes in this. He says, I've called the MS Society and I got a package of information sent to you and I've got a package of information coming to me. He said, because as a GP, we only learn 20 minutes in school on everything. Oh, like, yeah. We're not experts, but he says, I'm going to learn now.
Yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah, and the funniest thing is when I was growing up, and it would have been grade 7, the librarian at my school started the MS Readathon.
Oh, wow.
All those years ago, grade 7.
This is
Lorraine Dilling,
yeah.
Huge circle.
Yeah.
And I saw her a number of years after my diagnosis, and she would have been probably late 70s, early 80s. I went to her house because she didn't live far from my mom and dad. And I said to her, why MS? Like, you did this readathon thing, and why MS? She goes, I don't know. She says, I just looked for a charity that was pretty small and didn't have much funding and thought, oh, I want kids to read. So, oh, we'll donate the money to MS. And yeah, and all these years later, it's still going strong.
Isn't that wonderful?
Worldwide now.
Isn't that amazing? So let's talk about Paralympics, because you've achieved the Olympic dream, perhaps not in the way you originally thought you would.
Mm.
And I want to ask you, my question is, you've done rowing, you've done cycling. What happened to swimming?
Well, funny enough, I did get classified as a para swimmer. And it was because in 2005, the World Masters Games, for the first time ever, were having para classifications in swimming and athletics.
Yeah.
So I actually got classified as a para swimmer, went and did the games. I mean, the only reason I wanted to go is because they were in Canada and I was going to come home for this. But I did really well. I think I won like 6 gold medals and 2 silver or something. And
yeah, you did really well.
As a para swimmer at the Masters Games, I mean, there weren't a lot of us. So, you know, I did well, but yeah, there weren't a lot of us.
That's okay.
And I came back and I competed here. You know, I was in my 40s. I competed here as a para swimmer, and, you know, they line you up by your time. So I was sitting in the marshalling room with like 12 and 13-year-olds, and some of them, you could see them whispering. And then one little girl turned around one day and said, how old are you anyway? And I looked at her and said, well, I'm probably older than your mother. But yeah, so
bless.
Paralympics Australia, or the Paralympic Committee, as they were known back then, heard about my racing in Canada as a master's. Now, master's swimming starts at 25. So they had no idea how old I was.
Mm.
And they sent me an invite to come to a talent search day.
Mm.
And I sent him a message back and I said, yeah, do you have any idea how old I am? They're for kids in the early 20s. I said, ah, come anyway. So I rocked up that day at the Victorian Institute of Sport and I was 44. I walked in with all these parents and their kids there, and I'm sure they were all looking at me going, where's your child? And I went, hey, I'm here for the testing. And I was 24 years older than the oldest person there that day.
Oh, wow.
And I did the testing, did all the testing with them. And it was 2 weeks later that I got a letter from Paralympics Australia saying, could you please take up the sport of rowing? Because in 2008, it's a brand new event in Beijing and we're looking for athletes to take up rowing. And so I did, and never ever thought about rowing, but it's water-based. So, hey, I was happy.
And no balls?
No balls. And the best thing is that the number of times I fell in the Yarra River, I was able to swim. So my swimming came in handy eventually.
Yes.
With rowing. Yeah.
So you started in sculls by the sound of it.
Learn to row. You're in a big eight,
yeah.
You know, because it's easier having four balance and four row. But eventually, yes, trying to get into a single scull, especially for somebody with no balance, is really interesting.
Yeah.
And learning that, because if I focus on one spot, then I'm okay. But if I have to turn my head or look around, then that's when things go haywire. And yeah, so that was fun. So I did a lot of swimming while I was learning how to scull.
So I want to ask you about, again, these inflection points, these mindsets, because we've spoken about the mindset of high performance. We've spoken about the mindset of an elite athlete. And again, it feels like all your life you've been honing this mindset, perhaps consciously, perhaps unconsciously. You know, what was that moment like getting that letter from the Paralympic Committee and saying, hey, we think you've got something and we want to encourage you to take up rowing? And then, of course, you've done other things and you've won lots of medals at the various games and all those sorts of things. You know, really celebrated athlete. But it's not something that came overnight. It's something you've obviously... It's a long journey, right? And this is one of the things I really admire about, is the stickability.
That goal, you know, that goal is that seven-year-old who wanted to represent her country at the highest level of sport. You know, in 2005, I get this letter giving me that possible chance of still being able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at the age of 44, being told, you know what? You could maybe still reach this goal you have as a seven-year-old. Yes, it won't be the Olympics. It'll be the Paralympics. It won't be for Canada. It'll be for Australia. And it won't be in swimming. It'll be maybe in rowing. Then it was like, you know, man, that's a goal I've had since I was seven. Why wouldn't I go for it?
Yeah.
You know, as it was, I made the national team rowing. And then 2008, we went to the last World Cup that we possibly could qualify in. And we missed by 0.8 of a second.
Oh.
On that journey there, it was like we had no doubts we were going to go.
Hmm.
We had no doubts that we were going to be there. And then when it didn't happen, it was my sister via cyberspace that gave me a swift kick, because I'd actually been writing a blog about our journey to get there. And I wrote a blog apologizing to all the followers who'd been following this journey that we weren't going to get there. And that I figured, you know, this is way too much now. I just didn't think I could do it. And my sister gave me a swift kick up the butt via cyberspace and said, Carol, it's not about the destination. It is about the journey. And you've taken us on an amazing journey. And why would you stop rowing? If you enjoy it, just keep rowing. Don't worry about where it's going to take you. Just enjoy it. And she was so right.
It sounds a little bit like your mother's advice all over again.
I know. I've got a great family.
Yeah.
Giving me, you know, these kicks. I mean, that was a very disappointing time that, you know, we'd worked so hard and we just missed. And so I made the team the following year. We came sixth at the World Championships and we thought, wow, you know, this is great. We got 3 years to work together as a crew. We can go to London. We can kick ass. And in 2010, we had a coach who, well, even in 2009, he was just a terrible coach. The night before our final, he pulled us all together at the World Championships. And he said, oh, you guys should just be happy you made the final.
What?
Yeah. He did not care about the four. He was more interested in the more disabled boats. So he just didn't give it. I think that was a real bad mindset for most of the crew to take into that race. And I think that's why we did so badly. We had the worst row of our life, but we ended up sixth out of six, you know, in the final.
Yeah.
But the following year, politics came into play within Rowing Australia and this coach. And he lied quite a bit to the high performance director. And we got invited to selection trials for world championships. Then we got uninvited. And then there was just nothing happening with the four. And the four, we had two men and two women in para rowing.
Hmm.
And the other woman that was in the boat with me, she lived in Sydney. She lives in Sydney, Alexandra. And she'd started cycling. And she called me in, I guess it was around January of 2011. And she said, Carol, they've got a trike category in the Paralympics. I said, what? And I had had a trike made just to ride back and forth to rowing because I had no balance, the balance on two wheels. And she goes, yeah, you should come and race at nationals. And I'm like, I don't know how to race a trike. She goes, just come and have fun. So I did. And after the first time trial that I'd ever done, the head coach came up to me and he goes, it was in Queensland, up around the Glasshouse Mountains where we had our race. And he just looked at me and he goes, where the hell do you come from? And I said, Melbourne. And he goes, no, in the cycling world. And I said, well, no, I'm a rower. He goes, no, you're not. You're a cyclist. He says, you just smashed the qualifying speed for the national team for your category. And I said, oh, what was that? He goes, don't you even know? I said, I know nothing about cycling. And he said, oh, I better talk to your coach. And I said, well, keep talking because I'm my coach. I've got a rowing coach, but I don't have a cycling coach. And that was thanks to him. His name's Peter Day. Thanks to him, that was the start of my cycling journey, which, you know, is still going strong 11 years later.
And you've achieved some tremendous success as a cyclist as well. So I know that it's probably poor form on my part to go, can you list off these achievements? Because it probably puts you on the spot, but let's not hide this. You've had some incredible success as an athlete and you've won gold medals, you've won world championships, you've won, you know, all this stuff. So how's that?
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Well, seriously, Jesse, I still shake my head and go, what the hell's happened in the last 11 years?
Yeah.
You know, I got the last spot on the cycling team for the 2012 London Games Paralympics. Unfortunately, I had to race the men in London because we didn't have enough women to hold our own race that they figured countries would pick who would be strong enough.
Okay.
So they factored the race. So I remember being 50 years old and I was in a hotel in Queensland and I got my email saying, congratulations, you've been selected for the Australian Paralympic cycling team. And I was just over the moon and I phoned my mom. I think I woke her up. It was really in the middle of the night going, I've done it. I've made the team. And then a week later, I was off the team because another rider had appealed my selection because she had missed out. So there were only six spots for the females on the team. And that's across road and track. And I was only doing road and she could do both. And so we had to go to an appeals tribunal and then I was back on the team. So they upheld the coach's decision to put me on the team. And so, yeah, I went into London very kind of like, oh, I've got to make sure I perform because, you know, I've had all this, you shouldn't be on the team and you're not good enough. That's how I, you know, that was getting said to me by somebody else. And I ended up winning the time trial after the factoring was in place. And it was funny because I was sitting on my trike sitting on a bike cooling down just on a trainer. And I remember our media lady, she's in there, she's looking at her phone because we couldn't hear the loudspeaker and the results as they were coming through because I was probably the fifth last to go off. So there were still people behind me who were finishing. And she's saying, Jenny's saying, I think you've got this. And I'm putting my hand up going, no, don't say anything. I want to hear it on the big speaker. I don't believe it. Not everybody's finished. And yeah, so it was when the Great Britain coach came in and stuck his hand out. And I'm still pedaling on the bike. And he goes, congratulations. I said, what for? This is 10 minutes later. And he goes, you just won. And Jenny looked at me. She goes, oh, my God, I've been trying to tell you for the last 10 minutes. You won the bloody thing. So I just burst into tears because to be honest, the success for me was just getting there. And, you know, I'll go and talk to people and hold up my gold medal and say, how many of you think this is success? And they all put their hands up and I go, no, it's not. The success was getting there. It only took me 42 years, two countries and three sports, but I finally got there. And the success was doing the best that I could possibly do. So, you know, even if I come dead last, I couldn't have done any more than I'd actually done. I like to say that the medal is the icing on the cake, or, you know, I hit this in a cycling terms, I hit the summit by getting to the games, but I hit the snow-capped mountaintop by winning the medal. So then I was like, well, you know, I loved riding and I'd met some really good people riding. It's like, well, what do I do then? So my goal, because in 2011, I'd come second at the world championships in both time trial and road race. And so then what was my goal? Well, I wanted to win a world championship. So that was for 2000. I never look far. I don't look that far ahead. I just look at the next year. And so I did. I won both road race and time trial in 2013. And then all of a sudden, like for some reason, all of a sudden it was 2016. And I'm now on the team again. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I didn't ever expect this. But we had our own category. We had our own race. The women had their own race. Right. So it was great. And I ended up winning both the road race and the time trial in Rio and just kept going, I guess, just kept riding. And I guess I tell people that, you know, when you're involved in sport, you have to be passionate about what you're doing for any kind of success. And I just love riding. So it's my health outlet. It's my friendship outlet. It's my social outlet. And I love the feeling of a hard training session and the endorphins you get from it. I don't ride to make a team. I ride because I enjoy it. And I just am lucky enough that I'm good enough and I'm still qualifying for the teams. So I didn't think at all that I would be in Tokyo.
Tokyo, yeah.
I know. I was 59, supposed to be 59 going to the games. And of course, then they postponed them. And it was like, oh, well, I'm a completely different athlete to other Paralympians because they're all young and they're, you know, building, they've been, you know, trying to work, trying to go to school. I've done all that. This is just a little bit extra at the end of life, you know, on the other side of all of that. And so it didn't upset me that much. I just thought, oh, well, will I make the team because I'll be 60. You know, I'm thinking, God, how can I compete against 31-year-olds and 30-year-olds? Yeah, it was, I made the team and I thought, well, I got to do the best that I can possibly do. We'll see what happens. And I put everything I could into it. I ended up with a silver medal, which to me is my gold medal moment. Because I had a really good race. I worked my ass off that extra year to just be there. Then the road race came up and unfortunately it didn't end very well. Canadian girl who actually beat me in the world championships in 2011, she crashed in front of me in Tokyo 9 minutes into the race.
Oh no.
We were coming downhill at about we worked out 58 to 60 kilometers an hour and it was pouring rain.
Oh no.
And she didn't quite take the corner too well. It was a sweeping right hand corner. And she crashed and I could see what was going to happen because there was nowhere to go and I hit my brakes and I just slid. There was, you know, the roads were so wet. We have safety bars on the back of our trike so you can't come in between two people's back wheel, people's two back wheels. And I hit the German girl right on the back left, which pushed her out of the way. And I hit the Canadian's bike. Went head over heels and just tried to relax into it. I thought, don't try and stop yourself. You're going to break something. And as it was, I hit the road at about 45 kilometers an hour. And I remember once I stopped sliding down the road, I kind of lay there and took stock and thought, okay, nothing's broken. Just get up because everybody at home around the world's watching this live. Get up, get up. And so I did grab my trike. Tried to ride, the wheel was smashed. So they replaced the wheel. The mechanics right away were there and replaced the wheel. And I jumped back on, blood running down my legs because I had skin off from hitting the road. And I was a bit sore on the right side. And I remember going up a little tiny hill and the doctor and the medical doctor in the car came beside me. He goes, "Are you sure you're all right?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm fine. I just want to catch them. And it was adrenaline talking because then I hit the 3K climb and I couldn't breathe. I was just having trouble breathing. It turned out I had a punctured lung. So I ended up being taken by road ambulance to hospital, chest tube put in. I might add, in Japan, they don't believe in pain meds. So they did that with no freezing and no pain meds. Oh, that was not fun.
No.
And spent 6 days in a Japanese hospital on my own. Google Translate works really well sometimes. And but I always like to find the positive. There's a silver lining in that I'm the only athlete in the world out of the Olympics and the Paralympics who got to stay in Tokyo and be a tourist. Yep. Because I couldn't fly. I couldn't fly for another 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so one of the staff members from Paralympics Australia stayed with me, and the translator from Jeff, who was from his wife worked at the Australian Embassy, and he'd been our cycling translator. He was our tour guide, and you know, he would pick us up each day and say, "Where do you want to go today?"
Oh, something good.
And something good came out of a pretty horrific time for 6 days. But hey, you know, it's what you make out of life.
Well, I think that's a real theme in your life, isn't it, Carol? You've been able to take those events, which seem like adversity. And, of course, they are adversity, but you've been able to reframe them. You've been able to take the lesson from that. And what I take from this, there's lots of things I take from this, is, like, I don't know if this, I'm trying to find a good expression, but it's really around that persistence, that stickability. My dad is about as dinky-die Aussie as you can get. And he would use this expression. So I'm going to use this expression, but it's a term of endearment. It's definitely meant.
Oh, my husband says that all the time, so I get it.
Yeah, he'd say there's a bit of mongrel in there, and meaning like, you know, like there's someone who's got some tenacity and who's kind of going, I'm not done. I'll tell you what. I'm going to ride up that hill. I've got a punctured lung, but you know what? I'll tell you when I'm ready to stop.
As a Canadian. My mom would say that I was born pig-headed and stubborn. So it's a bit of mongrel, or I'm pig-headed and stubborn. Same thing.
But it's a really wonderful attribute, because it shows, I think, a huge amount of grit and determination and a lot of, as I said, courage just to keep pushing forward. And I love that. I think it's a wonderful trait.
I think I've got my motto across a lot of my stuff is, dare to face your fears and believe in yourself, and you can accomplish anything. And it's so true. It's so true in anything in life and for anyone. I think, you know, as we get older, we all get so fearful of trying new things, or, you know, attempting something different or changing something in our life, because we've learned to be fearful throughout life. And I always put it back to, we watch children when they're learning how to walk, and they haven't learned what fear is yet. And they might stand up and fall down hundreds, if not thousands of times. And sometimes they'll laugh and sometimes they'll cry, but they always get back up. And I think as adults, we have to revert back to that fearless child when we want to try something. And it doesn't matter if we're good at it or bad at it. If you enjoy doing it, just do it. You know, don't worry about what other people might think, because to be honest, so many people are just so engaged in their own self and looking down at, and I say looking down at their phone as a, you know, an idea, that they're not looking at what you're doing. They don't care what you're doing. It's what we put, the perception we put on ourselves. And it's not what you see, but it's how you see things and how you can turn those negatives into positives.
Carol, you've been an incredible guest today.
Oh, thank you.
I have just enjoyed talking to you so much. I could talk to you for days on end. I'm really aware that you've got a couple of books that I just want to tell everyone to go out and get, because I think, A, it'll give them some really good inspiration, some great strategies, and really hopefully help them develop their own tenacity and grit and a bit of inner mongrel if we can. And so, ladies and gents, head across to Carol's website, which is carolcook.com.au, and there's two books there. One's called Finding Your Inner Gold, and the subtitle to that is A Gold Medal Paralympian Secrets to Success, and I'd encourage you to grab that. And then the other one is The Force Within, which is the journey of from police officer to Paralympian. And just grab those books, get stuck into them, because I think some of the lessons that Carol's been talking about, life lessons that have held her in such good stead, all the way dating back to, you know, being that, you know, 9-year-old girl, I think is a really wonderful lesson for all of us. And I tell you what, I don't know if your mum's still with you, but...
Yes, she's around and kicking.
She sounds like an awesome lady, I tell you. She sounds...
Hey, she's got a bit of mongrel in her,
she's
too.
She's got a bit of mongrel.
I'm going to forward this podcast to her. She'll do this. I was actually speaking to her this morning. Unfortunately, my auntie, who is just amazing, I was lucky enough to finally go home after 3 years in August. Our world championships were in Canada, which was great, and I went home. And I spent, you know, 5 days with my auntie, and she unfortunately just passed away last week. Shouldn't have happened. It was, you know, it was such a shock. She was healthy and whatnot, but she had a fall, and 2 months away from her 90th. And my mum's the youngest of four, and they were all still with us up until last week, and they're all living on their own and just full of mongrel, the whole family. I take after really good stock, I tell you. So I was just talking to her mum this morning, and, you know, how are you? Yep, I'm good. I've got my days now. Your mum's 86. She'll be almost 87. She'll be 87 in May. You would never know it. You know, like, she's just full of grit and determination. And yeah, I think my sister and I are very lucky that we come from some pretty strong female backgrounds in our lives.
Wow.
For sure.
What a wonderful role model. Well, Tell your mum from Australia that is a term of endearment, that if she's got a bit of mongrel in her, that's a big green tick of approval.
Well, she does understand that when somebody says it's a term of endearment. My husband called her an idiot one day when she was here, and he goes, but it's a term of endearment. So she'll just laugh when she hears that.
Very good, very good. Well, Carol, thank you once again. I'm really grateful to you for taking the time to come and talk to us. It's been a thrill and a pleasure to get to meet you and to get to talk to you today. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse, for having me. And yeah, it's been wonderful and great to meet you too. And I hope we can keep in touch.
Oh, definitely. Thanks so much, Carol.
All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.